Blog Talk Radio.
That theme means it means movie geeks are on the air.
It means that the greatest times in Blog Talk Radio are on right now, as far as you're concerned, because we have the greatest movie show on the whole entire network. And I'm going to say the whole, as far as podcast goes, you're not going to do much better than our show. So
the
just
planet,
deal with it.
The best in the planet,
best in the universe.
I would say other worlds. Yeah, other worlds and other planets too. I mean, we dominate there as well.
No, I mean, we're all over the place. We're the best. No, and I'm not just saying that because, like, I couldn't sleep the other night because of that Fourth Kind trailer, okay? I'm just saying.
I still haven't seen that. I'm getting Fourth Kind and Paranormal Activity confused.
Oh, okay. Well, it's just a crazy trailer in one sense because Mila Jovovich, the actress, comes out and introduces herself. I'm Mila Jovovich, and I'm going to be playing this character based on true events and everything.
Right.
And, you know, of course, if you're me, you're thinking, oh, my God, this is like Communion with Christopher Walken. And it's just, if there's something really freakish about the trailer, I mean in a not an overt, scary way, but when you think about what the trailer is, and if you're like me, you've seen it a number of times in the last week because of the movies you've seen and everything, it's just like, this is kind of creepy. And
well,
I know people that believe this stuff.
Well, it's about alien abduction, right?
Yeah. Oh, and I know people, I work with people who believe this, and I don't know, Jamie. It just sends a bad vibe down my spine.
And you work at a mental hospital, right?
No, I don't. I work at a captioning company, captioning software company. But, yeah, we get this stuff. But, no, in all seriousness, it's a pretty effective trailer. I don't know. If it's, you know, I've read a couple of books on the subject matter in my lifetime, but it's a messed up trailer. That's all I'm going to say.
Well, I've read a lot about this Paranormal Activity and movie, and they're saying that this is the big scare picture of the year, and it includes real home video footage of you know, ghosts and paranormal spirits and all that kind of stuff, and they're actually using a marketing tactic on this movie that's befitting a movie like this. They're sending it out to college campuses and screening it for college kids to get the word out.
You know, in one sense, I think that's great. In another sense, I don't know how great that is, but it's an effective trailer. I have to say it like that. That, you know, after watching it a couple times, it's effective. I didn't even hear about this movie until 2 weeks ago, to be honest with you. So, It's creepy. That's the best way I can describe it. It's creepy.
Yeah. Well, I need to check it out. I haven't checked it out yet. We have a great show tonight.
We have an awesome show.
Yes, we have Jacqueline Frost, who's written a book called Cinematography for Directors, and it's a really good book. And I've said it before, it's beautiful. The stills that they use, that she uses in this book to reference different films and color schemes and styles and movies. It's a gorgeous book. And also Nicholas Goosen, director Nicholas Goosen, who has an interesting story and the story of his life and how he became involved in filmmaking.
Right.
And he also has a great movie. It's called The Shortcut, and it's really effective, and it surprised me. It caught me off guard. Which most movies don't do that. So we'll be talking about that one a little bit later, too.
Sounds good.
In terms of movies out now, Jerry, did you go see The Informant?
Yes, I saw The Informant, and anyone who follows me on Twitter, and I feel sorry for anyone who follows me on Twitter because of the world's most boring tweets. Yes, I did go see it. And you know what? I liked it. I don't think I loved it as much as everyone else because, like, for the first half hour, I'm waiting for something to happen. I think the first half hour of the movie, you know, a lot of people complain about voiceover narration. And I don't know if you've noticed that in your lifetime, but a lot of people say how unnecessary it is. And this film, it's essential because without it, I might have walked out. But Matt Damon's voiceover narration in this film is so funny that yours truly laughed out loud a couple times. And then the second act takes over. And I was just in it. I couldn't stop laughing.
Good.
And that's a new thing with Soderbergh, because Soderbergh's not always that funny lately, but when this character, and it's like, I don't know, it's like The Usual Suspects on laughing gas, I guess.
Right.
Is the best way I could describe it, because this guy's a chronic liar. He's delusional. He's insane. And he's like Kaiser Soze, not as menacing as Kaiser Soze, but he's...
Well, he was bipolar.
Back when they
didn't know what that was.
No, they didn't know what that was, but there are revelations. You want to go along with him for the first half of the movie, and then you realize everything that you've been fed is bunk, and it's what you when you realize this, and it's a revelation after revelation. You're like, oh my God, you got to be kidding me! And that's what's so great about the film. I think that in the film's second act, I mean, I would hate people to walk out of this film like halfway through because they would really miss the payoff, and the payoff is enormous.
Hmm.
I mean, it's the kind of film a lot of people would be very frustrated watching, I think. But if you're willing to sit through it, and it's not a long movie, the payoff is tremendous. He's really, dude, he is so far gone. He does things, Matt Damon does things in the second half of the film. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
How's the music? Because this is the return of Marvin Hamlish after 13 years without
the music
a film.
Is good, and the music does stand out. That's the kudos to bringing it up because it has this very time period feel to it. And, you know, this is the early 90s, I guess, and I don't remember this case. I remember when the movie was announced. And it's been the movie's been announced like the beginning of this decade, but it has a feel to it. It almost has, I want to say, a 70s vibe to it, given the music and everything.
Mm.
But, Jamie, the film is just, if you stick with it, you're just going to be like, your mouth is going to be left hanging open. You're just like, I can't believe this.
Yeah, I got to check it out.
I think it's worthwhile checking out. I really do.
So Matt Damon, he, of course, is in the new Eastwood film Invictus, the Morgan Freeman, Nelson Mandela, apartheid soccer concoction from director Clint Eastwood. Doesn't that sell it, the movie right there?
It does for me, in all seriousness.
Yeah, but it's unique because Eastwood rarely works with the same actors, but he has already signed Matt Damon for the lead in his next film, which is a supernatural thriller in connection with producer Steven Spielberg.
Really?
So Eastwood doing I think it's called Hereafter or something. Eastwood doing a supernatural thriller.
Hmm. Well, it doesn't surprise me, and yet at the same time it does, but I really wish, because I thought Gran Torino was just so incredible, and I'm curious about this other film, but supernatural film? I wish he'd do another Western. I don't mean like an Unforgiven. I mean, I really wish he'd do another. He likes the Western genre. He really understands it, and I wish he would do another one. And there was talk a couple of years ago that he was going to do another Western, and I guess that fell through, but I would love to see him do that.
Yeah, I mean, it's got to be a real special Western for him to come back to.
Well, I know. And I'm not talking about doing, like, Fistful of Dollars again or even Pale Rider again. I'm talking about doing something, I don't know. But a supernatural thriller. Now, let me ask you this. Is this based on a book by any chance?
I'm not sure. The only thing that takes me about it, and it's why I admire Eastwood many times more than I admire his films, is that as he's gotten older, he's branching out. I mean, he's not going gently into that good night.
No,
I mean, he's challenging himself.
No, that's true. He is challenging himself. Now, the reason I say that is because he had made a movie a couple of years ago, a true crime, based on an Andrew Clavin book. And then Andrew Clavin wrote a book, a supernatural thriller after that, or even maybe that's all he writes now, called The Uncanny or something. I thought it might be an adaptation of that. And I didn't want to see him get stuck with doing another adaptation. I'd like to see him, when he's at his strongest, with the exception of Bridges of Madison County, he's at his strongest when he's doing original material, I've noticed, or at least scripted material not based in a book, because, I mean, I think I was disappointed in Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. I was hoping for a lot more.
Yeah.
I think the film has some good performances in it, but overall it's lacking. And I think that's true with Absolute Power, too. But and even the Michael Connelly book, Bloodwork, which should have been a natural for him, I think most of the time he works better when he's dealing with an original script or with his own script.
Yeah, that's probably so.
Yeah.
It's probably true. Also, there's a couple other news items we need to speak about before we bring on our first guest in about 15 minutes. Weinstein Company.
Yeah, it's hard. I make that mistake, too. I always...
They're shuffling all over the place again. The film Youth in Revolt, you've seen the trailers to this.
Oh, it's a great book. I read the book a long time ago. It's a great book. I strongly recommend it to everyone.
Yeah, it looks like a reasonably funny trailer.
Oh, it looks hilarious. I mean,
so they've pushed that from October to January.
You're kidding.
Yeah, they have.
Wait, not even January? What is every... You know, if you push everything in January, people are going to lose because everything gets pushed to that month. I mean, there's so many big movies coming out at that time right now that you're going to lose.
I guess they went to Toronto. They saw Single Man, which is the new Tom Ford-directed movie. Colin Firth, I believe, is getting a lot of praise for his lead performance in that. So they're releasing that Thanksgiving Day and pushing 9 to Christmas Day.
So 9 will go against Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That just upsets me because I got to wait another month to see 9.
Yeah, 9. All right, let me ask you this. Is The Road going to be directed DVD?
No. As far as I know, it's a theatrical release in a couple of weeks.
No, because I heard it was pushed back to that Wednesday before Thanksgiving.
Oh, really? It pushed that back from November 2?
Oh, yeah. Let's look at the Weinsteins. And we'll release Grindhouse for Easter weekend, The Mist for Thanksgiving, and we'll do The Road for Thanksgiving.
It is idiotic, but it's also an indication of their financial difficulties, I think. Maybe that has something to do with them saying, no, we don't have the capital right yet. Let's hold out a couple
right.
of months. And they have this. They finally have a slate of promising-looking movies.
Mm-hmm.
And they're playing musical chairs with the release date.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, you're right, November 25th.
Yeah, I just think, because I was looking at, I think, what is it, 2929 Productions is one of the companies, and they're associated with Magnolia, Mark Cuban.
Right.
There's a good chance that The Road will be video on demand, and that's a big movie. That's a big budgeted movie. They can't afford to do that way.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I haven't read anything about it being on demand, but Antichrist will be on demand in a couple of weeks.
Really? I'll be
yeah.
staying home for that, folks. If you want to, don't call me when I'm watching that.
IFC on demand. It'll be.
Oh, really? Because that would be great. I have to say this though. I wish these movies because it's very important for films like Antichrist and The Road and other and In the Loop to be in the theaters, because these are the kind of films, and we don't proselytize, we don't preach on this show, but we do like to see intelligent, well-made movies do well. Mm-hmm. I don't think anyone, any of us, the four of us, would argue with that. And while video on demand is a great service, it's a great service for people who don't have a landmark theater near them or an art house theater near them, these are the films that kind of need to do well, so we're not stuck with a lot of junk.
Yeah. Yeah, that is true. It's so it's disappointing, the changes in release. Actually, out of Toronto, the big head of Toronto is Precious. So
I knew that would be. What about the is the Clooney one Up in the Air doing well there?
Oh yeah, oh yeah. I mean the raves. I haven't read a lukewarm review on it.
Yeah, that's a big. That film is just taking over the whole festival circuit this year.
Yeah, yeah. But Precious, it seems like the little movie that will, by all indications, and it's being really touted for its performances. So we're going to see some newcomers and some people that we wouldn't expect to see nominated for Oscars come up from that movie.
Mm-hmm.
People like Monique and somebody like Mariah Carey, and certainly the lead girl in the film is getting major
praise.
And it's a movie that many critics are championing, including Roger Ebert. So that's out of Toronto, which is closed. The festival is closed.
Right.
We haven't actually talked... Well, let me mention this before we get into our next subject. Indiana Jones 5. Have you heard the latest news about this?
It's a go. Or as our good friend Hans Landa would say, it's a bingo.
That's a big go.
You knew I'd have to get something in.
That's right. Yeah, well, it is a go. They spoke to Harrison Ford, and he confirmed that Spielberg came up with the MacGuffin, the major plot theme, the driving plot of the film, which is great.
Mm-hmm.
The discouraging part of it is... He then said, so George is working on fleshing it out right now.
Well, you know what that means. Oh, my God. You know what the sad thing is, Jamie? 20 years ago, if I would have heard that, I'd been like, oh, cool. That's awesome.
Yeah.
You know, but not now. No.
Yeah, so, but he said, you know, if the script is good, I'll be happy to do it again. I would be equally excited to see another Indiana Jones, I think, but... With a note of caution, because I want it to make up for the last one.
Oh yeah, there's no doubt about that. And I welcome a new Indiana Jones. I welcome a Rambo 5, even as outlandish as it is. I welcome it. But it's Indiana Jones. I really welcome, because you know a lot of people were willing to give it a pass. Oh, it was fun. It reminded me of my childhood, which is the same excuse I used for The Phantom Menace. But, you know, when that fades, it's like, no, it wasn't a very good film. It's not as good as it should have been.
Right.
So maybe this fifth one will, maybe they'll be like, they'll take, I would hope they'll look at the criticism and they'll really try to make a really great film.
Yeah. Just when you thought the series was dead.
Well, there you go, folks. Malcolm McDowell lives forever on our show.
Yeah, so hopefully something, yeah, I'm open for it. I'm open for it, especially if Spielberg has more of a hand in the story construction. I think that'll be great.
Oh, I think if he has more of a hand, it's always a good thing. It never dawned on me, and it should have. But it didn't. That would be one of the disappointments of last year.
Yeah, absolutely.
It just never dawned on any of us. I mean, Aaron loved the film. More power to him for seeing something more positive than the rest of us. But for the most part, though, even people who, you know, we love the original series, it just wasn't that good.
It's all we could talk about in the weeks and months leading up to it.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean.
Yeah. So hopefully that'll look good and we'll get started soon, since no one's getting any younger. Also, we haven't been on the air since Patrick Swayze's death.
Mm.
So I want to talk about that a little bit. Patrick Swayze, it's you hear all the tributes coming in from co-workers and co-stars
right.
that have worked alongside of him, and by all accounts, a very generous and natural presence on screen, and a generous actor, and kind of a generous soul. What movie memories stick out for you from Patrick Swayze?
Ironically, it wasn't Dirty Dancing until late in life, but the first movie that I really, well, Red Dawn and Next It Came, but it really was Red Dawn, actually, and not a movie that I loved all that much when it first came out, but I just grew to love him. But it was really Point Break for me. He was just the epitome of cool in that. I was in college, and he was just awesome in that film. And I think as I got older, I went back to Dirty Dancing, and he's incredible in that movie. And the more I learned about him growing up in my life, and I really respected his role in that movie. But it's really the last 2 years, I hope any of us, God forbid we're ever in that situation, can put up the fight he put up. Because he worked till the very end. He worked, in that sense, he worked like Robert Mitchum. Worked till the very last day, almost. And now Robert Mitchum just was from old age and lived a longer life, but he worked till the very end. And I can't help but respect that with Patrick Swayze. I was just blown away by, you know, you think that he's the kind of person, okay, well, he has this pancreatic cancer. My dad was a cancer specialist, and that's one of the worst cancers.
Yeah.
And he was fighting, you know, he fought that thing to the very end. I can't help, I don't care who you are or what you think of him, that's a brave, brave person.
Yeah, very brave, and also very special relationship he had with his
mm-hmm.
wife of so many years.
Yeah,
he was very athletic. He was in great shape. Obviously, a dancer and athlete.
Mm-hmm.
My memories of him. Obviously, he made some of the defining movies of the 80s,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you don't realize how many he was involved in until you look back at his resume and you're like, oh, Outsiders.
That's another one. You're like, everyone was in Outsiders.
Yeah, Coppola's Eye for Talent again.
Yeah.
And then Dirty Dancing. I mean, who else could have sold that line, nobody puts baby in a corner?
It's one of those great lines. I mean, it's just one of those great, great movie lines.
Yeah. Then of course, like you said, Red Dawn, there's a movie that I love above all others. It's one of those guilty pleasures of mine.
Remember, Keith Ulick says there's no such thing as guilty pleasures, and I've really stuck with that since you said that. So what is it?
Yeah, it's not. It's just a term I use to. But it's Roadhouse. I mean,
dude, that movie's awesome. Ben Gazzara. Everyone's in that movie. That's a great movie.
It's an incredibly fun movie.
Yeah.
And he has the swagger and everything. I mean, he's just, everyone goes for broke in that movie. They
mm-hmm.
just, they're committed to that material. And it's just a lot of fun. So I remember living with that movie a lot longer than the others he was involved in.
Mm-hmm.
Dirty Dancing wasn't
yeah.
really, as a young boy, Dirty Dancing wasn't really my
right.
cup of tea. I think girls took to it. And then he went off and he did the Guy movie, Roadhouse.
Mm-hmm.
But I do, and I remember around that time he did his Barbara Walters interview. And I remember automatically liking him because, remember, that was the interview he got choked up talking about his father.
Right.
And how much he loved that man. And it was a very emotional interview. Barbara Walters used to be the expert at pulling out those interviews. From I will make you cry.
Yes, no, she, yeah, I mean, there's no doubt about that.
Yeah, so it's a sad loss and a really great man. And he's gone, but his movies remain. I never got to see The Beast, the series he was on TNT.
Mm-hmm. No, I'll be honest, I did not watch that either. No, but he was in a lot of things, and you know, it's really, I think it was on ABC News last week. They showed he was actually on an episode of MASH.
Of what?
MASH.
Oh, really?
And he played a character who had a life-threatening disease, and it was like he was very defiant that he was going to live his life on his own terms.
Hmm.
And that really, I was watching that, that blew me away. That really caught me off guard. I did not, I would never have known he was on MASH. That would never, I haven't seen MASH in so long, but it was really interesting that the people, whoever doing the tribute, found the scene, and it was just like, wow.
Yeah.
It was very heavy.
And then he went off and he did something like, of course, Point Break, but then he went off and he did something like Tu Wong Fu. He wanted
yeah,
to...
Yeah, that's another movie that people yeah. aren't bringing up.
He wanted to tackle different things, and then he shows up out of the blue in a movie like Donnie Darko, and it's like...
That, he was great in that.
A cultural icon from the 80s coming back for Donnie Darko. It,
yeah.
It up the cool factor of that movie.
Oh, big time.
Yeah, yeah. It's amazing. His memoir, actually, he wrote a memoir with his wife, and that's coming out in October, I think, if not later this month. Also, Edward Kennedy's memoir will be out. So that'll be good.
Yeah.
And you should read it. You should read it in a voice like this.
That's out right now, actually. That's
oh, is it already out?
Oh, no, it's out. It's got nothing but rave reviews. Actually, Doris Kearns Goodwin, who knows a thing or two about the Kennedys, from her book The Fitzgerald and the Kennedys, which she supposedly plagiarized, I think that was a big scandal a couple of years ago. She said it was the most, it was the first really in-depth insider account of a Kennedy we've ever had.
Wow.
This is really, actually, I'm probably going to buy this and read it this week, but it's supposedly, like, really well written, but also just as far as insider account goes of this family,
right.
it's one that you want to read.
And then the Emmy's on tonight.
Yeah, but let's not beat around a bush. What else starts tonight? Let's not beat around
exactly.
a bush.
Exactly. Let me just say about the Emmys. My hero will win an Emmy next year. Mr. Pacino will pick up an Emmy for playing Dr. Kevorkian. Mark my words, I am Nostradamus.
You heard me.
Yeah.
You know, Jason is going to fight with you on this tooth and nail.
Probably. He fights with me about everything that I know, for certain. Yeah, Curb Your Enthusiasm starts tonight as well, and I cannot wait. I've read reviews on this season, and apparently the Seinfeld reunion starts in episode 3, and it's a plot to get his wife back, because he's going to give her a role on the reunion show.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Larry David in interviews, he won't admit whether or not he tried this in real life, because a lot of the stuff of the show comes from his real life, you know, the things that irritate him, the little things that irritate him in life, and his pet peeves and encounters and things. And he draws comedy from that. I think he's brilliant. I think it's great.
Oh, I think
so,
it's just incredible. I can't wait to see. You know, on last week, I was at the gym, and I hadn't seen Seinfeld in many years. Do you know, and it was on. And you know the first episode I've seen? Do you want to take a wild guess what the first episode that I've seen in its entirety? The Contest.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that was just, I was like, oh my God, this is the first episode I've seen in years, and this is the one.
Yeah, you know, I was never a big Seinfeld guy. And yet I love Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Oh, yeah, well, you see where some of it comes from, although I am beginning to think, watching Curb Your Enthusiasm more and more each season, that Larry David is really the real genius behind the whole thing.
Yes, and the reason why I love Curb Your Enthusiasm is because with Seinfeld, it was the extra characters, the characters on the sidelines, the supporting characters that flourished. And Seinfeld was kind of, you know, the stabilizing force in the middle.
Right.
Larry David, as Larry David in Curb Your Enthusiasm, is the most colorful person in the cast.
Oh, he is, without a doubt.
And you either love them or you hate them. I happen to love that kind of humor and that kind
of... Oh, it's great humor. You just can't help but get worked up. It's one of the funniest shows. It's uncomfortable humor, but you can't help but get wrapped up in the laughter of it.
Yeah.
He's just so insane.
Let's bring up our first guest tonight, and then I'd like to talk to you about the news of Blockbuster and the home entertainment field and how much it's changing and what we can look forward to in the future.
Okay.
You know, that's a kind of dying business. We'll talk about that in a little bit.
Okay.
But we're very excited to bring up our first guest tonight. Cinematography for Directors is a new book from acclaimed filmmaker and teacher Jacqueline Frost. This wonderfully written and gorgeously designed book covers the nuts and bolts of one of the most crucial collaborations in film production, the relationship between the director and their cinematographer. Of the book, director Penelope Spheris raves, to anyone remotely interested in filmmaking, it is a beautifully written page-turner. Ms. Frost currently teaches cinematography and advanced film production at California State University Fullerton, where she is an associate professor. And in addition, she regularly teaches a course through UCLA Extension entitled Cinematography for Directors, on which this book is based. It's a great book, and you can pick it up right here from our website. If you click that icon of the front cover of the book on the homepage here, it'll take you directly to Amazon, where you can purchase the book as you listen to the show. And it's a great pleasure to welcome to our show Ms. Jacqueline Frost. Ms. Frost, are you with us?
I am here.
Thank you so much for calling tonight. I apologize for the mishap last week, but we're thrilled to have you on now.
No problem. Thank you for that wonderful introduction. Very nice.
I love the book. I can't wait to talk to you about it. But first, give me a sense of you and how movies became a part of your life. What were those early films that moved you?
Early, wow, that's a more complicated question than you can imagine. But there is a few films that have just jumped out at me. I became interested in movies just when I was a kid, home from school with Mono, watching the 4:30 movie, and I watched classics like, you know, Streetcar Named Desire and Mildred Pierce and
mm-hmm.
all these different films, and I was just engaged, you know. So I became interested in film when I took a film history class in college, and that kind of became my thing, you know. I got really interested in movies, and then I wanted to learn how to make movies.
Mm-hmm.
So films like The Graduate, you know, those are the kind of that every year I'll show that to the students, and I watch it myself, and I always get something else out of it. The beautiful color cinematography of Douglas Sirk's films.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Rebel Without a Cause. I mean, there's so many, you know.
So did you find yourself drawn to the immediately to the photographic aspect of film?
Well, no, not immediately. I mean, I started off as a fine arts major, so I was into drawing and painting. And as a fine arts major, I had to study a lot of art history. So I realized in studying paintings that I was studying light and composition.
Mm-hmm.
And in still photography, I was really into the technical aspects of working with lenses and f-stops and depth of field and stuff like that. So it just was a natural progression to get interested in being behind the camera.
Yeah, yeah. And so you studied, where did you go to school?
I went to a whole bunch of places. I graduated from the University of Florida as a fine arts major, and then I went to NYU for a little while, didn't stay there, went off to San Francisco State, loved it there, shot a lot of films for people. So then, you know, you shoot something that's in focus and looks half decent, and so you we shoot my film too. Sure, okay. You know, so I shot a lot of films there, and then I went off to I taught for a while in Oklahoma, of all places, and then I wound up at the University of Miami, getting another degree, and I was shooting there. So by then, I was really specializing in producing and cinematography.
Right, right. And tell me about your relationships with when you were the DP on some of these projects, your relationships with the directors and what you learned from those experiences.
Yeah, you know, I realize that directors are really that are passionate. They have something they really want to say, and they really want to get on the screen. They don't really always know how to do it, you know, and they don't know the technical means of how to express how to do it. So I really like collaborating with people, you know, and I found that there was a need there, you know, that they they had a great idea for something, but they were like, well, how do we do this? And then I'd say, okay, well, I think we can use this stock and this angle and this lens and blah, 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 and we can do it. And they're like, okay, cool, cool. You know, so for me, it was very satisfying to get what they wanted up on the screen, you know?
Excuse me. Go ahead, Jerry.
Yeah, did you feel, because that's a very important thing you bring up, because a lot of people, myself included, we don't get the technical thing. So do you find yourself bringing that technical expertise to the set a lot to people who otherwise don't understand it?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Yeah.
I don't feel that bad now. But no, but the reason I ask is because it's very important to know that. And if you have that skill, I've always found if you have the technical, the scientific skills to bring that to the set, you're as good as gold.
Right, right. Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry. That's a lot of the reason for you writing this book, because, I mean, the book is called Cinematography for Directors, and that's not cinematography for cinematographers necessarily. So tell me about that distinction.
Well, that distinction is that you know, a lot of cinematographers are techies anyway. They have a, you know, they're aesthetic people. They consider themselves painters with light. They have an artistic vision, but you know, the book, they don't need the book. The directors,
it's true.
You know.
True.
Right.
The people who want to tap into those resources, the people who want to, you know, may get a really proficient cinematographer on set, but they don't know how to talk to them, really, you know, how to express what they want. So I wrote the book for directors, and I learned that from teaching that class at UCLA that there was really a great need. You know, I'd get people who were actors turned directors, writers turned directors, people who just, you know, directors that just didn't know a lot of this stuff, that were like, okay, well, how do we, you know, what do we need to know to talk to these people?
Mm-hmm.
So that's really the focus of it.
And the director and the cinematographer, you talk about the DP is a director's closest ally, or should be, on the set. Is that true? Tell me about that communication, that relationship.
Yeah, well, you know, the director's got a lot of pressure, let's face it. You know, the whole, everybody on set's looking at the director like, okay, what do you do next? And blah, 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 blah. What's the next shot? What's the next setup? You know, they need somebody to turn to and say, okay, blank in here. What should we do? The director is, the director of photography is there to really support the director's vision, you know, to help them.
That's
you know,
true.
To be the shoulder to lean on, you know? So
how much information or knowledge should the director, because this is the basis of your book, should the director come to the set with, and in building that relationship with his DP, should he know, how much should he know about lenses, the technical aspects of it?
That's kind of a mixed kind of thing, because when I talk to cinematographers from the ASC, some of them say they don't really care if a director knows technical lenses and can say, you know, I want a 32 or a 27. They don't really care about that. What they really want a director to have is a passion and enthusiasm and to really know kind of, okay, I want this kind of angle. How do we do it? They want to be able to collaborate with them, you know. So to know everything technical is not, you know, essential. It's helpful.
Right.
You know, it's very helpful.
Yeah.
They don't have to be a Soderbergh, is what you're saying. They can,
no,
as long as they have, basically, and I don't mean that in a bad, I don't mean that in a bad way at all, but as long as, but it, you, basically, you want the director, you don't want the director to be just a gun for hire. You want the director to be there to say, well, I was thinking maybe if we do put the camera here, and if we could do this. You don't want the director to be like, oh, I don't really know. What do you mean? What do you mean the lens cap isn't off? you never want that.
No, not really.
But and also they use, there's a chapter in your book about this. It's useful to use visual references.
Yeah.
Yeah, whether it be from paintings, which I know a lot of DPs study the great artists in terms of the lighting, or other films. But at the same time, you don't want your film to be derivative of those references.
You know, there are some cinematographers that I talked to said that a director sometimes will come to them with, like, a lot of pictures, you know, maybe stills from magazines or old photographs or some sort of filmic reference or, you know, something like, I kind of want this feel. And you take kind of the essence of all of those things and come up with the visuals that you're going for. It's not like, I want my film to look exactly like Goodfellas, but, you know, the essence of it, you know. A little bit of this mixed with a little bit of this, which a little bit of Skip Leach to get this look, to blah, blah,
right.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's, you know, it's just a starting point where they can at least, they may have references and then the film doesn't even look like that, but at least it's a starting point for a conversation.
Mm-hmm. There's the dilemma for the beginning filmmaker. How do they go about finding a cinematographer for their project?
Yeah, it depends where they are. You know, like if you're if you've got a script and you've been funded, if you're in film school, it's easier because there's people right there and you can look at their work. If you've got a project and you've got a little money, then you've got to kind of look around through resources to see people's reels. You have to have the meetings, the one-on-one, to see if you connect at all. There's so many cinematographers out there ready to work, you know, for a really good price, a really good deal. But you have to see if it's a fit. It's a fit for your project and if it's a fit for your personality.
Yeah, and certainly it's dependent upon also how well the DP responds to the script.
Oh, yeah.
To the material. Because they're
not about it, they'll bring something to it. If they don't really want to do it and they're just doing it for the money or whatever, you know, then they're not going to be as enthusiastic in the collaboration.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because they really are, we talk about this a lot, every member of the film crew is an assistant storyteller. And in terms of plotting your camera shots or movements, those have to be motivated by the script.
Right.
And so the DP really does have to have storytelling skills, experience.
Oh, for sure, yeah. I mean, like the second chapter in there that I have the cinematographer in the script, you know, when they get a script, they sit down and read it just like anybody else would, you know, whether like just like a producer would, just like an actor would. They just read it all the way through and they think, is this something that moves me, that I can relate to? Is this something that I want to be a part of, you know?
Yeah.
Is this something I'm interested in? Is this taking me to another place, you know, maybe challenging me or, you know? And then they'll read it again and start to think, okay, technical, like how can I maybe add a little, you know, maybe suggest a dolly shot here, or wide angle, or they'll start to get creative ideas there afterwards, you know?
Mm-hmm. But even, it's not only the relationship between the director and his cinematographer, because isn't it crucial that people like the production designer and the set decorators, those talents have to be involved in those conversations as well, correct?
Oh, for sure. The production designer is kind of the third entity in that little duo there. And even I talked to a cinematographer the other day who was saying that the first AD is part of the deal too, you know?
That's true. I've heard that many times.
Yeah. Because, you know, it's got to be how many sets you can do on, what can you get done in a day, you know? So you got to be working with them.
Yeah. You talk to a lot of, I think, like 8 or 9 very acclaimed cinematographers in this book. You feature interviews with them throughout.
Yes.
And a couple of them we've had on the show, people like Daniel Pearl and Matthew Libetek. And, what information did you glean from them, for instance, about the kinds of directors they appreciate working with the most?
Well, Matthew in particular, he was very big on the director and him being friends. You know, he really likes to feel comfortable with the director, hang out with them, you know, the kind of person that you just really observe what tastes, you know, what are they drawn to. So he's very much about that. Because, you know, he met Darren Aronofsky in film school at AFI, and, you know, and he got to work with one of his idols, Spike Lee, many times now.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, you know, they've established a friendship, really. Daniel Pearl is kind of more about what challenges him creatively. You know, like, that he's not in love with horror films, necessarily, but he's gotten known for shooting them, and he likes to be able to go into the dark areas there and shoot
right.
something in that kind of genre, you know?
Yeah. Do they find the directors, I'm sorry, go ahead,
okay.
Finish your thought.
No, I was just going to say, he's also one who, you know, he loves a collaboration. And that's, you know, that's what they want to be. They want to be collaborators. Every director, cinematographer I talk to wants a collaboration. They don't want to be, like you said earlier, a gun for hire. Just put the camera there and push the button. I mean, anybody can do that.
Are directors becoming more daring in terms of their visual approach to filmmaking in the past couple of decades?
No, I think they are because they can. You know, you look at earlier films in cinema history, you know, there was a semi predetermined look to certain genres, but at the same time, they didn't have some of the technical abilities that they have today with CGI, with what they can do in digital intermediates. So
right.
It was all sort of chemical process, but now, you know, with a DI, you can do pretty much anything you want.
And how much has the digital revolution transformed what they do?
I think it's very apparent in post-production. And it's just, you know, there's a lot of controversy still in digital image capture. You know, there's a lot of, most cinematographers still would prefer to stay in film for, you know, to get the main negative captured that way and then manipulate it in post. But what they can do in post is just, you know, amazing. Although there are still a few diehards holding out and just saying, you know what, I'm sticking with photochemical. I don't want to do anything in the DI suite. I just want to do, there. I'm a film purist and I'm staying in here. Paul Thomas Anderson is one of those guys.
I remember that passage from your book. Yeah, I think the DP said, you know, you can't cheat with Paul Thomas Anderson.
No, you can't. On so many levels, you really can't.
Yeah, and what a great collaboration that is. And There Will Be Blood, and oh, it's amazing.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful book. It's called Cinematography for Directors. It's available now. Like I said, you can purchase it off of our website. Before I let you go, I want to ask for your picks. If someone asks you for three films, just the most brilliant examples of terrific cinematography, what would the first three films that come to your mind be?
Oh, man, that's a hard question.
That's why I save it
for
last.
Off my head, yeah. Let's see. Well, in terms of a cohesive unity that's been done in cinematography, you can't not mention the Godfather series shot by Gordon Willis.
Right, no, of course.
You know, Gordon Willis is a master, you know, and I would be remiss in saying not mentioning him. So that gets me off the hook easy with that one. But contemporary, you know, Roger Deakins, if you look at his work, I mean, it's not even one film. It's the body of his work. And when I was pulling stills for the book, I was amazed at the way he could light and the way he composed. He's really quite brilliant.
Yeah.
So pretty much anything he shot, you know, it's just, you could take it apart and it's beautiful as still images. You know what I was drawn to, though, I have to say, it's the work of Douglas Sirk's cinematographer Russell Meddy back in the 50s. Those films are so beautiful.
Oh, they are. They really are.
They have just, they really inspired me and stuck in my mind for decades, so I'll have to throw those in there too.
Those are great choices and all very bold. They're pushing the envelope, and with Douglas Sirk certainly in terms of color, Gordon Willis in terms of darkness, you know, how dark can it be? Before you can't see anything.
To really pick some of, really the best of light and dark right there.
Yeah, and he's getting that honorary Oscar this year, which is so well deserved. And of course, Roger Deakins, his work with the Coen brothers is just remarkable.
Yeah.
And I'm taken by a lot of those stills that you choose for your book. There's a great chapter on color schemes. And you notice that a lot more with multi-layered, multi-character pieces like a traffic, where each section has its own color scheme, and it's very striking.
Yes, yes, and that's becoming I think that's becoming more predominant in today's films. I don't think that was done quite as much in the past. It's become something that's even more subtle. It's just it could be just, you know, a different stock on a different character, but it's enough that you know you're in a different world. You know, this is a different storyline. They're all weaving together, but it's just slightly desaturated or slightly warmer or slightly cooler, you know, that ties it all together.
Right.
You don't have to put a title card, you know, now we are here. You know?
Exactly. They have their own kind of temperature, and you're, you follow it according to that look. They're brilliant, brilliant choices of films that you spotlight in this film and in this book, and I love the book very much, and I appreciate you coming on and talking about it.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
Okay, let's do it again sometime.
All righty,
yes,
for sure.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
The book is Cinematography for Directors. Purchase it right now. Do it. I don't see you clicking on that icon. Do it right now.
I'll do it.
Okay. Thank you, John. It's a wonderful book. It's actually...
No, it sounds that way.
I was really taken by this book. It's just gorgeous to look through. Cinematography, you know, Gordon Willis is amazing. He's done such amazing work.
Oh, he has.
Felix actually brings up Days of Heaven, which...
No, those are... Any Terrence Malick film is...
In the annals of cinematography, though, Days of Heaven stands right at the top.
Oh, without a doubt.
Yeah.
You're not going to hear any argument from me about that. No, that's very good.
Okay, so before we bring on our next guest,
okay,
I want to talk about home entertainment.
Okay.
Blockbuster.
Okay.
Is shutting a lot of their stores down. Yes, they still have Blockbuster stores.
Mm-hmm.
They're shutting about 900 to 1,000 of them down. They have over 3,000, I think, in the country.
Right.
So a third of their stores are closing down.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, they're investing in, I think, about 10,000 standalone boxes, like the Red Box. Is that what it's called, the Red Box, where you go?
Yeah, the Red Box, where you go, like in your supermarket, they have the, or drugstore or whatever, they have the thing where you... I mean, that Red Box is sort of the ideal way that the studios are like to make, you know, every time you watch the film, you pay something for it. That's kind of like the, at least right now, like the ideal model for like some studios, that you would pay for it every time you watch it. So
it's just amazing how rapidly this marketplace changes.
Oh, it
because,
does. Big time.
Because years ago, it was... People aren't going to the movies anymore because they're renting videos, which wasn't really true, but I'm sure it did have an effect on box office for certain films. And then it was on demand. You could order it, you know, on your TV. It's very convenient.
Mm-hmm.
And the video stores are saying, you know, that's taking a bite out of our business. Then Netflix comes along, and that's a whole new way of receiving product. And so all the major video rental outlets felt threatened by that and tried to start their own. And now Redbox, which is definitely taking a bite out of everyone's pie. So it's just changing so fast.
No, it is. And I actually discovered something about Netflix last night on my iPhone. There was something called PhoneFlix, and I can access my Netflix account through iPhone,
wow,
which is very disturbing.
Oh, yeah, iPhone has, like, you know, 10 million applications.
Yeah, but you don't understand. So this means I can, like, go to my instant queue or whatever that I have on there and watch something in bed. So this is a totally disturbing development for me. So this means, yes, I will finally get to break into the instant viewing queue that I have, and I can do it in bed. So, yeah, Jamie, this is bad news. But
I don't know that one of these things will take off. I don't know that movies on your computer will take off or really make a dent out of. Maybe I'm just wrong about that.
Well, no, you're not wrong about that. I don't enjoy watching. I've watched a couple of movies for the Netflix instant queue on my computer, and it's not fun. Now, supposedly with the Blu-ray player I have from LG, I can use that same Netflix application and watch them on, you know, my TV. I would prefer to do that. I like to do that more than I would. I just don't enjoy watching things on my computer, and I know for some people that has become the norm, but for me, it's just not that fun.
Yeah, I do think it changes when you can connect to your TV from your computer.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that changes the ball game. But even going on a site like Criterion, the idea is attractive to me.
Oh, you know about that too. Oh, great. Okay.
Yeah, you can order certain titles of theirs online for $5 and watch them. I just don't want to watch them on my computer.
No, I don't either. I don't find it fun.
Yeah, it's the same thing with a cell phone. Who would want to watch a movie on a cell phone?
I have no interest in it. I can watch maybe a YouTube clip for 2 or 3 minutes. That's about it.
Yeah. Lawrence of Arabia on your cell phone.
It defeats the whole purpose.
Verizon Wireless presents Lawrence of Arabia. I don't want to see that day come.
Yeah, I don't want it would defeat. It would really just it ruins the movie. You really do have to see that. I'm lucky because the AFI near me shows that every summer, every Sunday, 70mm, and that's how I first saw it. The restoration '89, but that movie, that's a movie that just can only really, I think, be seen in a theater.
There are certain movies like that, to maintain maximum power, yeah.
I think Gone with the Wind, there are certain scenes in Gone with the Wind, the scene where they, the Atlanta, with all the bodies and everything, that was meant to be seen in a theater, not on your TV set.
Yeah, it's just an interesting marketplace because we're looking at formats that will probably be obsolete in years. The standard def DVD, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
We'll go the way of videotapes. I mean, Paul Schrader said it. You know, well, DVDs are going to be outdated, too.
I'm hoping Paul's wrong. I'm really hoping that Paul is wrong.
Well, Blu-ray, they're coming out with a 3D television in 2010, which I think will be a real kind of novelty at first for home theater enthusiasts.
Mm-hmm.
So 3D coming into your home, it's who knows where it's going to go? I have no idea. And how much it will affect the act of going to the cinema to have a shared experience.
Yeah. I don't, you know, well, I think this is all fine and dandy because that's where it is all going towards that. You know, nothing beats going to the movie. Really, nothing beats going to the theater. I don't care what movie it is. I don't care whether it's something that's as therapeutic or cathartic as Inglourious Basterds or something as small as Adventureland or 500 Days of Summer. Or nothing beats that theater-going experience.
Yeah. I agree with you. So did you see anything other than The Informant?
I saw Jennifer's Body.
Oh, was it a nice body?
Well, I mean, yeah, I guess you could go to... No, because I really sort of kept my head in the clouds about... I didn't know the exact plot line of this movie, and I actually think it's not bad. I think Amanda Seyfried, the girl from Mamma Mia, is very good. She's in the movie. Megan Fox is, well, Megan Fox. And when she's trying to say... There are moments in the film where I think Diablo Cody, who is a good writer, I'm not going to put that past her. I like Juno. I've said it a couple of times on a show within the last 2 months. But you see, you hear these lines of dialogue that remind you of Juno, and you know that Cody's thinking this is like these are clever lines. And when Megan Fox says them, they fall flat.
Mm-hmm.
I know people disagree with me on that, but you really do. At times, you realize that Ellen Page, and I know people don't like her. Some people don't like her. I think she was perfect for Juno. And when she delivers those lines, they're perfect.
Yeah.
And when Megan Fox does it, it doesn't come across as well or as eloquent.
Well, that Amanda Seyfried, I'm not sure how to pronounce her last name.
Yeah, right? I feel like I'm trying not to say her last name all that often.
But this is her year, because
mm-hmm.
the new Adam Egoyan film, all the reviews coming in from that, the film Chloe, are raving about her. They say this is her movie. This is her
oh,
breakout.
I believe it. Under
this is her
his
breakout
direction,
moment.
What we talked about with Michael Dana a couple months ago,
yeah.
I believe that. And Adam Egoyan is, if he can get a performance out of you, then yeah, that's gonna he's the one to do it.
Well, she plays a prostitute in the film.
You know,
if
I had a sister, I'm sure my mom would have sent her out into the field immediately. But yeah, the good.
Well,
for her.
So yeah, Julianne Moore suspects her husband Liam Neeson of cheating, so she basically sets him up on a business trip for the prostitute to meet him.
Oh.
And the prostitute comes back to her and reports in detail about their excursions together, which really starts to titillate Julianne Moore, and she begins a relationship with the prostitute, and then the teenage son in the family comes into the fold as well. So it seems like a very sexually complex plot for a Goyan to investigate.
Yeah, no, and if anyone can do it, it's him, because you just have to look at the way his films are structured. And, you know, we talk about Tarantino, and we talk about the gentleman behind The Burning Plane, and the director of the movies like Babel, who are the nonlinear structure.
Yeah.
Adam Egan's been doing this from day one. He's the expert at it, and I'm sure this film will be like that, but he's really good at exceeding expectations and also reversing expectations in a sense you don't know where his story is going to take you.
Yeah.
And that's definitely true with the one we were talking about with Michael when we interviewed him, Adoration. The trailers for his films don't do them justice, because they're not the trailer for Adoration is so misleading, but that's not his fault. It's just the way he makes his films. I don't know how you sell some of these ideas. They're so brilliant. But Chloe seems to be that way.
Well, Chloe is, they say, the most mainstream film of his career while still maintaining his particular stamp.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So they say it's
no,
a promise.
That's good for him. The C2 Adam Egan films in 1 year is very promising. So.
Yeah, and did you see that open letter to Megan Fox from the crew of Transformers?
Yeah, and then there's a response back to that. I don't know what. Yeah, I don't get it. I realize that they're trying to play on popular opinion maybe or whatever, but I don't see the point of doing it, because I got to hand it to Michael Bay. He came in and said, this is BS.
Yeah, when you're part of a Michael Bay production, and you're complaining that someone else is intolerable on the production,
yeah,
other than Michael Bay, you got to be bad. I mean, when you upstage Michael Bay.
I don't know. I mean, they did this, obviously this is time to coincide with Jennifer's Body release, obviously. I don't find a hard time believing it, but I just don't see what the point of it was.
Right.
I'm not defending her. I just think it's at this point it's childish.
Right.
I don't see where everyone wants to work in this business. I don't see where this kind of behavior gets you.
Yeah, it is puzzling. Meanwhile, I've been reading reviews. We're waiting for our next guest to call in. I've been reading reviews of The Burning Plane, most of which have not been kind. And they've all attacked the same idea behind the movie, that the separate narrative plot strands, the whole line that he takes in all of his other works, the multi-character works, multi-time periods, blah, 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 they said that's all for naught. I mean, why do you have that in this film? And my response to that is, play the film in your mind in sequential order, and it doesn't play half as well as how it plays now, where it's structured more as a mystery. I don't understand this criticism.
No, I understand the criticism, but you watch these films. I saw a film a couple of weeks ago. This one, maybe Babel is still the one that I found the easiest to figure out, where it was going. This one I knew where it was going, but I didn't mind. I thought the characters, the performances were very rich. I thought the three lead actress performances were wonderful. I knew where it was going. I didn't care. I was very curious about each character's motivation. The Kim Basinger part I thought was very...
And the motivations become clear to you.
Yeah.
Strictly because of the way it is told.
Yeah, I didn't mind that. I actually, I'm not going to lie to you. I don't think this... I actually do like The Three Burials better.
Yeah.
I like 21 Grams. And I know that's beside the point.
But those movies didn't come out this year.
For
me, this is one of the top movies of this year.
No, and it's a fascinating film, because while I do I can see where things are headed with the characters in the different time periods. It's still like, wow, why did they do this? Why? What was their motivation? But even beside that, I thought it was definitely one of Charlize Theron's most interesting performances in a very long time.
Yeah,
I like Kim Basinger, and I like the girl who was the young Charlize Theron. I thought that was a great performance, and it's a good. I don't think it's a perfect film, but I think it's a good film. I think it's good enough that it's much better than most of the other stuff you're going to see.
Strikes me as snobbery.
Oh,
it strikes me as people that praise someone for a particular style at the beginning of their career and for their particular voice, and then they crucify them for that same years later.
It's like that damned if you do, damned if you don't almost kind of thing. I knew where it was going. I didn't mind that. I was so wrapped up in the performances. I didn't really care. You know, it's this guy's directorial debut. Of course, you know, the director that he's worked with all these years and Tommy Lee Jones' direction is going to rub off. I didn't mind that. It's a good film. You know what? It's a good film. I think you're not going to be bored.
Yeah.
No, because I read the reviews and I'm just like, people, I mean, what do you want? Does everything have to be Paul Blart Mall Cop?
Yeah.
I'm serious.
That movie would have worked better if it were told out of sequential order.
I think that movie would have worked. That movie would have worked better if it was directed by Uwe Boll. But I mean,
you wouldn't question the motivation of the character. It would have been. I think it's a great movie, and actually, Jennifer Lawrence has found another gig. She has since we did our interview with her.
She was awesome in that film.
Yeah, since we did the interview with her, she signed on to co-star alongside Mel Gibson in Jodie Foster's new movie.
Now, let me ask you that. What movie is that?
That's the one where he starts a relationship with a beaver or something.
So that's no longer Hollywood folklore. That is actually a reality now.
No. That's a project.
We had talked about that a couple months ago So this is one of the greatest unproduced screenplay of recent times. And Jodie Foster is going to do it, and Mel Gibson is going to be coming to a synagogue near you soon. The Mel Gibson Goodwill Tour starts now.
It's called The Beaver. Yeah.
There you go. I mean,
I'll read you the exact plot line.
Oh my God.
A guy walks around with a puppet of a beaver on his hand and treats it like a living creature. Who will play the part of the beaver? I'm wondering.
Jerry Mathers is still alive. Is he? No, never mind.
Actually, Jodie Foster's in it, too. Co-stars is probably his wife or something.
Well, that, I have to tell you, I think that's very promising. I really do. Because I remember, you know, every year we hear about this film, or every couple of years, this is a great unproduced screenplay, and we talked about this a couple of months ago. So this is going to be really interesting to see this unfold.
You know, and before the stuff with Mel Gibson came out years ago, even before then, we liked Mel Gibson playing crazy, playing deranged of some sort, you know? It fit. And so now that fit makes more sense to us.
it fits. I will say this. I actually had this thing I had always, you know, before all this stuff came out, before The Passion of Christ, I always wanted to believe he was the character he played in Tequila Sunrise, which is a very down-to-earth, very humble character and a great character. And, you know, it's sad when you realize that's not the case. But, you know, given what he's trying to do, and he does have a sense of humor, all you have to do is watch the Lethal Weapon making of documentaries that used to be on HBO before those movies came out. Our celebrities are not always who we want them to be. They have their dark parts. What he said was, I personally think, is unforgivable. I think it's a horrible thing what he said, what he did. But he's trying to make amends. Let's give him the benefit of the doubt.
Well, he's one of our great movie stars. He always has
been. Dude, he's Mad Max. I mean, I have that on Blu-ray. I'm not going to argue. He's Mad Max.
They're actors, and then they are great movie stars. I think he's also a great actor, but he can hold a screen. You're just riveted by him in his best work.
Yeah, I'm not going to. I mean, he's probably our generation's John Wayne in that sense, and maybe to a lesser extent Charlton Heston. You're not going to agree with all his politics, and that's just the way it is.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's no, you can't deny. This is where I say you have to separate the man from the artist.
Well, we're talking about movies that get thrown on demand, don't get theatrical releases, blah, blah, blah. There's a movie that's out now. It's not really out now. It has received no advertising, no posters, no trailers, no nothing. And it's directed by none other than Joel Schumacher.
What movie do you speak of?
It's called Blood Creek. And it's out in, I think, 3 theaters now.
Blood Creek? You stomped me. I've never heard of this.
Yeah, I'm looking up information about it. It's amazing. This is a high-profile director who's made a horror film, which is a popular genre, that is completely not even on the radar. I mean,
right.
it's nowhere near the radar. It's in second-run theaters now. The plot line of the film, a man and his brother on a mission of revenge become trapped in a harrowing occult experiment dating back to the Third Reich.
Wow, what did they have me in mind when they made this film?
Probably.
All right, do you know any more besides that?
The Inglorious Blood Creek.
not even that. No, it's very interesting because there's this whole thing. Okay. There's a scene in the aforementioned Inglorious Bastards that you alluded to where he, you know, remember Hitler's very angry. I mean,
yeah.
Terrified that
yeah.
they would equate the bear Jew with the golem, which the Jews made as a monster to protect them in Jewish religion, Jewish mythology. And he's horrified that the German soldiers would refer to the bear Jew as a golem. I got a kick out of this because it just shows you how well Tarantino researched the subject. He was, you know, the one thing that Raiders of the Lost Ark, we don't give it credit for, enough credit, is that Hitler was obsessed with all those religious artifacts, really was obsessed with all the Jewish mysticism and all that stuff. They found a couple of years ago, I brought this up on a show, they found Jewish music records in his record collection.
Mm.
So he was very obsessed. You know, if you're that obsessed with hating a race, chances are you're obsessed with everything about their culture. And he was. And that scene where he's going ballistic, don't don't have them refer to him as a golem, please. It's just a bear Jew. Just stop it. You know,
right.
There's a lot of truth in that, in one sense. So, and he was obsessed. I mean, Hitler was obsessed with the occult. So now I'm very curious about this film. Now, great, I'm going to probably go hunt this film down.
It's curious how we don't know about it.
Yeah, I'm really curious. Who's
yeah.
in it?
No one I recognize.
Well, just read off some names to me.
At one point, Chris Klein and Jesse Metcalf were attached, but that changed. I guess it's a young cast. The actors, there's an actor named Michael Fassbender in it.
Michael Fassbender? Archie Hilcox is in it?
Yes.
You know who I'm talking about.
Yes.
Me and Keith Ulick have a man crush on this guy. I mean,
he's in it.
Jesus, we need to have Michael Fassbender on the show then.
Well, let's invite him on. He's also in Jonah Hex, which is the big high-profile
release.
He
also played Bobby Sands in Hunger, which I didn't see when it was on demand. But, yeah, he played Bobby Sands. He's played everyone now. I mean, he's in Jonah Hex. I mean, we really need to have Michael Fassbender on the show immediately.
I will definitely invite him.
I'll call. I'll make the calls if you need to. You know, what should we drink to? Down with Hitler. All the way down. Okay, I'll shut up now.
Okay, speaking of the occult, we're planning our next tribute show, the tribute to none other than Mr. Roman Polanski, and that will air on the 4th of October, and we've got a great lineup of guests coming in for it. You like that? You like that musical accompaniment?
Oh, I love that. It's awesome.
Yeah, it's so soothing.
I know.
I listen to it every night before I fall asleep. People like Bobby Osteen, whose late husband worked with Polanski editing three movies, including
mm-hmm.
Rosemary's Baby, Frantic, and Chinatown. And cinematographer William Fraker, who shot Rosemary's Baby.
Right.
And a couple of other great guests that we'll have on for that show. And everyone loves Roman Polanski, and we're going to hear a lot of interesting stories about him, which is he has the most fascinating life of any filmmaker that I know of. All right, enough of that.
No, but can you imagine? Now, I do like, and I know we'll probably get Aaron, we'll call in any minute now, but I do like the Two Jakes.
Yeah.
I really do. But I
yeah.
do remember when I went to see with my good friend Mitch Garrett, when that came out, I said, dude, do you imagine how much better this would have been if Roman Polanski had come back and directed this?
Mm-hmm.
And I just, you know.
Well, that's what they wanted. I mean,
I wanted that. Even as much, and I do like the film as it is, but can you imagine how much better it would have been had he directed
it? I don't know. Yeah, it probably would have had more of an interest. You know, it wasn't as iconic a script as Chinatown, not as enigmatic.
It couldn't be. It's what
yeah.
we talked about on this show. When you leave the source material that long, and that goes with The Godfather, as much as I love The Godfather 3, you know, it's true that when you leave it that long, it's not as fresh. Or let's go with the ultimate example, The Phantom Menace.
Yeah, but that was a real troubled production, Two Jakes. Not so much troubled while they were in production of it, but troubled to get to that point where they
yeah.
could be in production. I mean, it was they wanted Polanski, that didn't work out. Robert Evans was going to make it his big directorial debut, as he was with The Cotton Club for a while.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
That didn't pan out. Lots of animosity at that time between Nicholson and Robert Towne, the screenwriter,
mm-hmm.
and Robert Evans, and they've all patched things up now. But I mean, a lot of turmoil associated with that movie. I think Nicholson did an impressive job, told it as well and as inventively as he could.
Mm-hmm.
But they initially wanted it to be a trilogy because the first one was about water, right?
Mm-hmm. The second one was about oil, if I'm not mistaken.
Was it about oil or real estate? Was it about oil?
And I think the last one was going to be about air or something. The third one was air. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I would love to see a third one. The reason I say that is because I didn't mind Robert Towne's Ask the Dust, his adaptation.
I loved Ask the Dust, actually.
Yeah, I mean, it's great. You know, as good as we're going to get as far as a John Fante adaptation. And I wouldn't mind him trying to do a third Chinatown, close it out. And I think Jack, of all people, I mean, I'd like to think that he would be game. I'm game for it. If they're really serious, I would love to see it.
Yeah. Yeah, Nicholson, man. I mean, no one's like him. And there's a great scene that he has in The Two Jakes where he's looking at pictures of Mulray and...
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
voices are playing in his head from the original film, and he's
yeah.
just sitting there sobbing and wiping the tears from his eye. There's moments of him in certain movies where he is so completely vulnerable and emotional. And this being Jack, it takes you aback. I'm thinking of the last shot of about Schmidt as well, which is very
yeah.
similar to that shot I was talking about in Two Jakes,
mm-hmm.
where he's very moved to tears and. Those moments are very special from him. He's doing a James Brooks movie now. He's reunited with James L. Brooks. Movie with Paul Rudd, Reese Witherspoon, and Owen Wilson, and Nicholson's thrown into the loop there, too. So they always do good work together.
Yeah, they do.
So that's something to look forward to.
Mm-hmm.
Jerry, our last week, let me pull up my switchboard, let's see if our guest has called in, and he hasn't. I assume that he's not calling in.
Okay.
Our other guest for the night was Nicholas Gustin. His movie is called The Shortcut. He's an interesting guy in that he's always been interested in filmmaking. He started as an intern on The Wedding Singer, and Adam Sandler approached him just out of the blue and started a conversation with him, and has really shepherded Nicholas's career since. He's worked on all the Adam Sandler productions in one form or another. He gave him the opportunity to direct Grandma's Boys,
mm-hmm.
and now he's Sandler has started. Of course, he has Happy Madison Productions.
Mm-hmm.
He started another company called Scary Madison Productions for horror films.
Right.
And he's given Nicholas the opportunity to direct the first film out of that banner. And that film is The Shortcut. Comes out on DVD September 29th. So I guess the interview wasn't able to come off today, but we will invite him on another day as well.
Yeah,
and see
definitely.
If we can work that out. We got some exciting shows coming up. I can't announce them yet because they're not 100%, but we got some exciting guests in the cooker here. Last week's mystery movie song of the week.
Before we do that, I need to ask you an honest question. What did you think about the True Blood season finale?
That's a good question. I thought it was the worst episode of the season.
See, I was, okay, I think if I'm repeating myself from last week, cut me off. I thought the first season was up and down, and then I thought this current season was, like, rock solid. And then last week was just sort of, like, ending on just buzzkill, if you will.
Very much so. They settled the plot, and this season, or this show in particular, it is plot-driven. It's incident and plot-driven.
Mm-hmm.
Every scene of the season works up to this climax that we're getting in the last episode of the season.
Right.
So when you settle that, when you finish off that climax in the first 20 minutes of your last episode, you find that the remaining 40 minutes of the episode, everyone's just sitting around twiddling their thumbs.
That's a great analogy. That's really good.
There's no climax. I mean, there's no build up to anything. It's just all, you know, now we really don't have anything to do.
Mm-hmm. good point.
We don't have a story left. It was interesting how that worked. But.
Yeah. Well, they've got so much goodwill right now that hopefully the third season will, you know, start again, like really bang up, you know. So
yeah, I hope so.
I hope so. It really is a good show. I like Alan Ball a lot, and I think television is really where he thrives the best. So I'm looking forward to next season.
Yeah. And you want to know what I thought of that last episode?
Yeah.
What I thought it was?
Oh, God, let's hear it.
Exactly.
I knew, you know, Malcolm McDowell is getting the best press of his life. He hasn't gotten this good press since, you know, Oh, Lucky Man came out, or Britannia Hospital.
Yeah, he needs to come on our show.
He definitely needs to come on our show. We'd have to give him an hour, though, because he's the man.
Tell us some Kubrick stories.
Yeah.
I wonder what that's like for actors, though, or any talents. When they've got 40 years of work, 40, 50 years of work, and the one and sometimes the only questions anyone has relates to, in Malcolm McDowell's case, Kubrick, or a film, a work that was almost, 37, 38 years ago.
Well, here's the thing. He might not get that because he has that. I mean, while that is a very important...
He does get it. I mean, in all the interviews I've read of him, that's always like a top question, and that's what they talk about more than anything.
If he comes on our show, he's getting his Lindsay Anderson trilogy with If, Oh Lucky Man, Britannia Hospital. He's going to get tons of Caligula questions. He's going to get the player changes time after time. He's going to get, dude, we need to have him on for an hour because I got tons of questions for him.
I bet he gets Caligula questions from you. That's one of those movies you order up on your iPhone in bed, right?
In bed? Try at work.
Yeah, Caligula. Which they've remade Caligula, and it looks like a joke. It looks like, are you serious? I've seen a trailer.
Wait, did they remake Caligula?
Benicio del Toro and lots of high profile people in this.
Wait a minute, they remake Caligula and they didn't ask me to be involved.
Helen Mirren is back for it.
Oh,
and
my God, they remade it and they didn't ask me to be. All right, Jamie, you've really ruined my evening now.
It looks like a joke. It looks like a jokey
kind of... Of course it's a joke. I'm not in it.
Well, no, it looks like a Jimmy Kimmel skit. So I don't know if it's an accurate project or not.
I'm really kind of right now despondent, but okay.
All right, our mystery movie song last week, it was, if I had a drum roll, I'd play it now, but I don't. It was Chris Isaak, Baby Did a Bad Thing from Eyes Wide Shut.
Oh, that's good.
It's a good choice, a good choice.
Awesome. Now I'm really curious what tonight's choice is going to be. I mean,
tonight we're going sexy with it. I guess Eyes Wide Shut was sexy, too.
That is sexy.
Yeah. So tonight, even steamier. Going to end it off on a steamy note, as if Jerry's Caligula talk wasn't enough to get you started.
I know, really. I mean, I think Jason O'Brien hung up on us, but...
So who knows? Maybe this particular episode of Movie Geeks United will be responsible for, you know, many births 9 months from now. Who knows? But here is our mystery movie song of this week. Jerry, I think we'll be back Wednesday night. It's looking good for that.
Okay, cool.
We'll have an interview with Bobby Osteen that we're going to be playing, and some other guests that we're trying to line up now. So we'll see you guys back here Wednesday night at 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Pacific. Enjoy the Emmys tonight. Enjoy Curb Your Enthusiasm, especially.
Yes.
Enjoy Obama on David Letterman tomorrow night.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And there's also a PBS, there's a documentary on PBS tomorrow night. It's called... I forget what it's called, but it's about the making of a Steinway piano.
Oh, that's supposed to be very good.
Yeah, I forget what the title is, the main title, but I can't wait to see that. That played at the film festivals and things, and I missed that screening, but I heard great things about it. Actually won like an audience award at the Sarasota Film Festival, I think.
Hmm.
So, okay, we'll see you back here Wednesday. Thanks, Jerry.
All right, thanks, everyone. Have a great night.
Bye-bye, everybody. Here's your mystery movie song.